Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
He's going on to have a crack. He is, you know.
I'm loving big engines instead. Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Tottenham Way podcast as the row over last Saturday's officiating errors goes on. And within the past few minutes, Jurgen Klopp, the Liverpool manager, has said the right thing to do would be to have a replay. All that while Spurs sit proudly in second place with the prospect of going top for a while at least on Saturday if they win at Luton. So many reasons to feel good, but we can't seem to get away from the controversies of Saturday night. I'm Marcus Buckland. Tom Allnutt of The Times is here once more. So too Tom Barkley of The Sun and Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard. Now, as we record this, I'm looking at my phone, which says breaking news. The Liverpool manager, Jurgen Klopp, insists a replay of the Premier League match against Tottenham, quote, would be the right thing after Luis Diaz's goal was wrongly disallowed by the video assistant referee. Dan, your immediate reaction to that?
Well, I mean, we should say this is literally happening as we record. So I'm in the same position as you. I've just seen the quotes kind of pop up on Twitter. So I suppose there's a danger that we're missing some context, but I'm not really sure how much more context we need, really. I mean, he's come out and said he thinks a replay is the right thing to do. I think that's a ridiculous position. I mean, the obvious argument against a replay is that it would set an extremely wild precedent and open a massive can of worms. You know, every single time there was a refereeing controversy or a VAR error or the PGMOL had to come out and apologise, you would have teams demanding a replay. That has happened in terms of an apology from the referee's body around a dozen times so far as I'm aware. So do we go back and replay all those games? You know, how far do we go back? Do we go back and replay the Champions League final in 2019? I know that there's been some joking about that at Spurs in the last few days, given all the talk for a replay, which obviously Klopp has now kind of made Liverpool's official position. I just find it absolutely extraordinary. I have to say, you know, I think Liverpool deserve sympathy for what was a really bad decision. But I think in taking this position and in kind of reigniting the row the day after the audio has been released, they are, you know, rapidly putting themselves in a position where they will start losing sympathy and making themselves the object of ridicule. So for a number of reasons, this is a stupid idea. It shouldn't happen. I would be amazed if it did happen. And yeah, as I said, I think it's going to start shifting the perceptions of how we look at this kind of drama.
Yeah, as you say, it would set such a dangerous precedent. Tom B, first Tom A, your thoughts?
Well, looking at Jurgen Klopp's quotes, he does say that the obvious counter argument would be that exactly what Dan said, you know, that people would be calling for replays all over the shop. But his argument is that this is unprecedented in terms of what happened. And I do feel like it was a pretty unique cock up. We haven't quite seen that yet, but I have to agree. And I think most reasonable football fans will think the same thing for the points that Dan's just outlined. And I felt like after the game, because this whole fiasco seemed to come out after the match, or I think during Klopp's press conference, when originally the PGMOL revealed that it was a significant human error and held their hands up then, and he spoke very calmly, really, in the press conference and didn't really hit out too much over it, almost a slightly surprising way, but in a way that I think gained him a lot of credit, really, for speaking so calmly about it and not flying off the handle. So it's quite surprising in a way for him now to say something that's, you know, as significant as this in the cold light of day a few days later. And yeah, I'm sort of with Dan that most football fans won't take too kindly to that. And I agree. I don't see how this is feasible, given that it would only open a can of worms for every time we have a major issue, and it makes the refereeing situation even tougher.
It's surprising from Klopp, I think, because we've sort of come to think of Klopp as one of the kind of sage voices in football, you know, particularly someone who kind of usually stands on the right side of existential issues, like, I don't know, Qatar World Cup, for example. He was very good on talking about, you know, how on earth football allowed that to happen. He was one of the few big name managers from the big clubs who really spoke out against the Super League, for example. I think we've, you know, over the last, whatever, you know, decade or so, however long he's been around English football, you know, we've learned to kind of appreciate Klopp's views in this kind of thing. And I guess speaking to what kind of Tom just said there, that's why everyone was sort of like, yeah, you know, we can understand why Klopp would come out after the match and be a relatively cool head in what was obviously about to become a very frenzied situation. I can only imagine one of two scenarios has happened. Either one, he's being sort of put under pressure by Liverpool higher up. You know, they kind of want this issue to kind of continue for whatever reason, because they're still intent on exploring a range of options, whatever on earth that means. Or two, you know, he's kind of been dragged along by the whole kind of narrative and hysteria and hype that's happened over the last two or three days. Either way, you know, it's a ridiculous idea, completely ridiculous. I mean, I remember that, you remember that FA Cup tie that got replayed with the Arsenal Sheffield United, was it, in 1999, when they replayed a match because, you know, Arsenal didn't, you know, went and scored a goal when they were meant to be kicking the ball back. I can't remember another instance in English football when a match has been replayed. And to be honest, thank goodness that didn't set a precedent for what would be a completely disastrous idea. And I actually think even Liverpool fans, I mean, I suspect even Liverpool fans are quite surprised by this. And I think Dan's absolutely right. Liverpool have gradually kind of surrendered the moral high ground here. You know, they've gone from being the club that people sort of feel sorry for to, you know, through the statement they issued, which I thought was a step too far, the idea that, I mean, what options do they want to explore? Are they going to sue the Premier League or something? To this today, now requesting the match be replayed, I think it's a nonsense.
Yeah, well, hopefully it will be batted away as quickly as possible by the authorities. And the thing that's frustrating me is this drags on, Dan, is that, you know, it's overlooking what Spurs have achieved. And OK, there was some fortune definitely attached to what happened on Saturday night. But they're unbeaten. We're unbeaten. And, you know, second in the league. And yet nobody's talking about that at all. Do you share my frustration in that regard?
I would bin VAR personally. We won't get into it too much. But I think one of the most tedious things about it is all this kind of endless discourse and screeching controversy it creates, and we've seen that more than ever in the days since the game. I mean, I think Liverpool do deserve sympathy. It's probably the worst VAR cock-up since the technology was introduced to the Premier League. You know, there's so many layers of mare to it, as the audio, which is kind of excruciating, by the way. If you haven't listened to it, I do recommend seeking it out, revealed. It's just generally distracted from the fact that it was a cracking game and, you know, not just a good performance by Spurs, but, you know, Liverpool deserve credit as well. And I think, you know, really we should be, you know, sitting here talking about, you know, two teams that look primed to return to the top four, that look like, you know, they're really going in the right direction again under kind of really charismatic, larger than life managers. And, you know, two very encouraging and interesting performances in very different circumstances. Obviously, Liverpool had nine men. But instead, you know, we're still kind of endlessly poring over discussion about VAR and, you know, five-point plans and how we can improve it and yada, yada, yada. And I just think, you know, I'm wary of looking back too nostalgically on, you know, the good old days, but let's just get rid of it and go back to letting raw emotion and human error kind of rule. You know, that's where I am with it. But yeah, it's a shame, because we would be much better placed kind of discussing Sonny rather than all this stuff.
Well, we will discuss all of that, but I have to concur with you, and I want to know what the two Toms think. I was actually in Rome on Saturday watching the game it was a pretty poor picture actually, but you got the gist of what was happening. And at the very end, when Spurs scored, I mean, it was an extraordinary finale, of course. All I'm worrying about is, oh, it's going to be disallowed for some reason. There was absolutely no immediate joy. There was just a sense of fear that this potential elation was going to be taken away from me and from the other Spurs fan I was with that night. And to me, this is the worst direct consequence of VAR, that you lose all your natural enthusiasm now, because whenever a team either scores, your team scores, or your team concedes, you immediately start thinking either, oh no, this is going to be disallowed for some reason, or, oh, actually cannot hang in there because we'll see somebody's fingernail has just strayed into an offside position. I really don't think it's too much of an exaggeration, Tom B and Tom A, to say that I think it's ruining the game, and it's absolutely destroying that human emotion, which is what football's all about. Am I going over the top, or Dan's right? Get rid of it.
No, I don't think you're going over the top on that. In fact, I think Ange Postecoglou talked about this. It was during a press conference or one of the interviews he's done recently about how he reacts to goals. He said
before the game he was worried about looking like a clown.
Yes,
during celebrations.
So, yeah, he tries to keep cool because obviously he does seem so cool on the touchline because he doesn't, as you say, look like a clown. And that sort of sums it up, really. And I'm definitely with you. I do think the reason this one has gone on and on and on is because it's quite unique. It's, you know, lots of goals have been proven to have been onside or offside, you know, the wrong decision. It's not that. It's the fact that they, how they went about cocking it up. And when you listen to the audio, it is remarkable, really. It's unbelievable. And I can sympathise with Liverpool on that point. The only thing I'd say to you, Marcus, on the suggestion of getting rid of it, and I am generally with you because of the passion that it takes out of the game, and that's what it's all about, is Pedro Mendes all those years ago. Obviously, that would be chalked as a goal with VAR, but wasn't then. So as long as you can handle that, then go with it.
Well, but what I suggest, and listen, I'm the last person to give anybody any advice, but basically VAR, to my understanding, was brought in to ensure that clear and obvious errors, such as the Pedro Mendes disallowed goal, would be dealt with, not that somebody's fingernail or armpit was in a marginal offside decision. And to me, it should take 10 seconds for somebody to say that's clearly, very clearly offside, or that ball has crossed the line, whatever it may be, not to forensically examine every wretched situation that holds up the game and ultimately leads to as much frustration as it does satisfaction. Isn't that what it was all about? Just sorting out very clear and obvious errors. That should take 10 seconds. If you can't do it in 10 seconds, stick with the on-field decision.
Although, ironically, Marcus, I would say listening to the audio, actually, my instinctive reaction was they did everything too fast. It felt like everyone was kind of talking very quickly, and it was like, okay, restart, no problem. Yeah, go ahead. And then within almost 2 seconds, Spurs have restarted, taking the free kick. It felt like everything had been done in a hurry. And if someone had just taken a breath and just almost said, you know, made just double took it and said, okay, just confirming this, confirm that. I mean, I know it's a cliche to kind of go on about how great rugby is in this scenario. But when you listen to the refs talking about decisions in that context, they always confirm, you know, try, just confirming try. Yeah, yeah. And you hear it so clearly, and they make sure, you know, and of course, yes, there is a delay. And I understand the irony here, because everyone's main complaint with VAR is it takes too long. But I thought in this scenario, everything was a little bit done too hurriedly. I mean, my general feeling here, and I've sort of listened to a lot of, you know, discussion and read a lot in the last few days, because obviously it's really blown up, is that, I mean, I guess there are two things. One, you can either be angry at VAR, you know, the kind of the process and the introduction of the technology. That's one thing. And also you can be angry at the decision, you know, and the decisions in the match. You know, I do think there was an accumulative effect. I wonder if the outrage would have been quite as much if it had just been the Diaz thing in an isolated incident. I feel like because Liverpool had two men sent off, because those two decisions were slightly contentious, it kind of built up. My view is I generally can't really get that angry and irate about these things. I understand that VAR is not great, and I would probably concur with Dan and say I wish it had never happened. But I also just can't help feeling in these things that people do make mistakes, and I really do. Like, people say, oh, at the highest level you can't make errors, blah blah blah. Like, everyone makes mistakes, and these are very subjective decisions. I see what you're saying, Marcus. You know, that clear things with goal line. It's like in tennis, right? When there's a line and it's in or out, yes, it's easy to do. But football is a subjective sport. Like, you have to understand that these decisions are ambiguous. And if there's one conclusion that VAR has taught us all, is that the rules of football are not clear. Like, they are very subjective. And you can't impose technology on them and think you're going to get 100% right. And the problem you have is that VAR has just raised everyone's expectations way, way beyond what is possible. They're basically raising expectations to say we need to get 100% of everything right all the time. And it's simply not possible. And it doesn't surprise me that you get these decisions where people make mistakes under pressure. Like, I mean, you know, blimey. I was getting a train to meant to be in Valencia to do a football match. I went down to the south of Spain, went to Cordoba, got the wrong train. That's a mistake. I was in a press conference with Dan the other day, and his laptop started talking in the middle of a press conference. That's a mistake, right? Like, we all make mistakes. I mean, Rishi Sunak has just cancelled HS2 or whatever, you know, it costs billions and billions of pounds. You can't tell me that's not the highest level. Like, everyone makes mistakes, and referees are no different, and even more so because these decisions are impossible to make. I love this thing where they say, oh, let's get ex-footballers, you know, in the studio, yada, yada, yada. I would love to see an ex-footballer referee a football match. I would honestly love it. They should do a documentary on Netflix or something where they get footballers to referee football matches. And I honestly tell you, I would love to see how many they get, in inverted commas, correct. I would even love to put us four in a room with no external noise and judge somebody's decision and say, is that a penalty or a free kick? And I guarantee you, we would not come to the same conclusions. So the idea that, yes, referees are well paid. Yes, they're well qualified. Yes, they've gone through training courses. I understand they should do better than we should. But equally, it doesn't surprise me that their percentages are 98% correct and that 2% of the time, that is what it is, by the way, 2% at the moment are incorrect. It doesn't surprise me that there is still that small margin. What surprises me is that people are still getting so angry about this. And I understand from Liverpool's point of view, and I understand this was a bad error because it was a miscommunication. I get it. But I also think, blimey, like, Diaz was onside by about 30 centimetres or something. It wasn't like, I mean, we're not talking about Diego Maradona here, you know, like it was a bad call because of the process. But in terms of the actual call itself, blimey, it was pretty marginal.
I enjoyed that impassioned speech, but I also think you've just articulated another reason why we should get rid of VAR. Because until AI runs the system and it's all fully automated by machines, humans have to be involved. And humans will make mistakes, as you said. So you are just, all you are doing is adding another layer of human error into the officiating process, all the while taking away the spontaneity that Marcus touched on at the start of celebrating a goal. When you've got managers like Postecoglou saying, I no longer can celebrate in the same way, then isn't that obvious that it's killing the sport? I mean, what is there left if you've no longer got the finality and the joy, the unbridled joy of celebrating a goal? That there's, you know, that there's not much left in football after that. That's the essence of the sport, isn't it?
There are two separate things here. One is to be angry at the fact that VAR has been introduced. Mm. And I share that. Like, I think, you know, I hate that thing where everyone always has to kind of think about, is this going to be a goal or not? You know, like, can we actually celebrate? I completely agree with that. But the sort of the outrage about, you know, this one decision and you know, people getting it wrong. I mean, blimey, like, it happens, you know, it happens.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I just think it's will continue to happen. They can change the communication protocols. They can train people as much as possible. But as you said, football is subjective. The rules are often in grey areas, and mistakes and controversy will continue to happen, which for me is the perfect reason to bin off VAR, because until we can get machines running everything for us to a 99.9999% accuracy, then it's, you know, this is just going to carry on.
And by the way, I just want one thing on the overshadowing. I actually just come from a slightly different angle. I wonder actually if it's not a bad thing for Tottenham for this all to have happened, because I just think that maybe the hype was growing so much that maybe actually just them slipping under the radar here and kind of great result, 4 points from Arsenal and Liverpool, blimey, like, fantastic return. But I don't think it's a bad thing that people aren't saying, are Tottenham in the title race this week? Are they the challengers to Man City? I think actually just a little bit extra longer going into the international break with a little bit just ticking along nicely, I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, in terms of the red cards as well, I think Curtis Jones was a little bit unlucky, but by the letter of the law, he had to go. And even Jamie Carragher, who's pretty one-eyed when it comes to all things Liverpool, accepted that decision. Jota's obviously very unlucky with the first yellow card, but once you're on a yellow, That's a silly mistake, a silly challenge. So I think to a degree, they were the architects, or certainly he was the architect of his own downfall. But let's take it forward then. You two boys, after the game the other day, the reaction pod posed the question of Spurs in the title race. And I think you both concurred that it's too early to say that. But just purely in terms of the league position, it's an incredible start. And actually, what because I wasn't there, I was away at the weekend. What I've not been able to gauge properly is how good or not Spurs were against Liverpool, who clearly will be part of the title race. So had that game stayed 11 against 11 and VAR had not had all its implosions, what do you think the outcome would have been? And effectively, were Spurs as good as Liverpool, or do you think over the next few weeks we'll see that there is still a bit of a sizable gap, certainly between Tottenham and maybe Liverpool and Manchester City?
I think Liverpool were a step ahead of Spurs, to be honest. I think, and which is not surprising, Tottenham are very much in the infancy of the Postecoglou reign. Yes, Liverpool have signed a lot of new players of late, and they are in a bit of a transitional phase themselves. But I think when you watch players like Salah, who I couldn't stop going on about after the game, my breath was taken away at times with his first touch and just how quick he runs with the ball compared to players without a ball. I mean, I know there was a moment which has gone around on social media of Mickey van der Ven racing back to cover for Salah, which was very impressive and showed his pace. But seriously, Salah was a level above everyone else on that pitch. And the fact that Liverpool went down to both 10 and nine men, I mean, it felt like Spurs were better up against them when they had 11 each. Liverpool were really, really impressive from their sort of defensive side of their game. And they had their moments, and James Maddison once again was very, very good. But if I was looking at it, as I said after the game, the reaction pod, watching that match, even though Liverpool lost, I only felt more that they looked like a title contender, and I wouldn't rule out Spurs, but I don't think they're on the same level yet from what I saw.
Well, I think, not to go back to the decision anymore, but a really interesting counterfactual would have been how Spurs would have done against 10-man Liverpool a goal down, you know, had Diaz's goal stood. I think that would have been a really interesting scenario to see. And I think we would have seen where kind of Spurs were at, you know, more so than seeing them break down nine men, which, you know, as many people have pointed out since the game, becomes almost like a weird training exercise. You know, it's not as easy as I think people realise to break down nine men, because the team with two men down are going to kind of defend from their lives and just pack the penalty box and play in a very specific way that, you know, the other side aren't used to contending with. You know, they're not really going to be going forward and leaving any spaces. They're going to be essentially playing, as Liverpool did, a sort of 5-3 formation, which is not easy to cut through. So I think credit to Spurs for getting there in the end. But I think we would have certainly learned more about where Spurs were as a side if they'd been playing against a kind of counter-punching Liverpool with a goal to protect, looking to play in transition. You know, that would have been a sort of test of whether they could, you know, have the intricacy and the creativity and the players to get through. I'd probably lean towards what Tom was saying, that Liverpool were shading it with 11 men, but I think it was a pretty even game. I wouldn't like to sort of draw too many big conclusions. I think, again, Spurs deserve credit for finding a way through, and I think, you know, Liverpool deserved credit for the way they played, you know, with a man and then two men down. And again, it's just a shame we're not kind of discussing two, you know, very promising sides this week.
Yeah, and I always remember a producer saying to me, I'd rather be lucky than good as well. And Spurs are good, but they are getting some luck, obviously, at that last-minute goal, where they turn things around against Sheffield United. And I felt over the past few years, of course, you make your own luck to a degree, but, you know, we haven't had the rub of the green, and it's fantastic that is happening. And it's also, Tom, A, fantastic to see Heung-min Son. And I know he's struggling a little bit with a niggling groin injury, but he's scoring for fun again. He's that cheeky chappy once more. You spoke the other day about this Son Mark II character. I mean, he's fantastic at the moment. And he's looking a natural goal scorer in the Harry Kane mould, isn't he, with Richarlison off the left? It's all fitting into place up front, dare I suggest.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if Ange kind of sticks with this now. I mean, you know, whether Son down the middle is going to be the thing, or whether he does think there are still certain games where him off the left is still, you know, suits the opponent or whatever. I mean, I think the way Postecoglou likes to play with his wing is so wide, really hugging the touchline, I think suits kind of Son 1.0 less. When we saw it, I don't know if we saw it maybe in the first game or two, but I definitely remember seeing it in pre-season. And I felt like, wow, Son's kind of playing a bit deeper and he's very far away from the goal. And I did sort of think it didn't quite look like his sort of favourite role. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Let's see. I mean, Son is a kind of predator. I mean, I think around the box, what you notice with Son is his finishing is so... it's so kind of cute and smart. You know, he doesn't just bang the ball hard, which you do get certain strikers do where they just, you know, leather it and hope for the best. He's got a lovely touch. You know, we've seen that a couple of times where he can just sort of prod things in and find little angles. And I think, you know, in a way, what he maybe lacks in kind of power and, you know, physical strength, I think he's got in kind of subtlety and he has an ability, obviously, to be quick in small areas so he can get ahead of people in the front post and the back post. I think he can do it. I really do. And I think more than anything, this Ange team now feels like Son's team more than anyone else. I think, you know, there are so many nice parallels between the two of them, you know, where they've played before, the whole sort of, you know, different cultures. Sonny, you know, in the dressing room is someone who very much kind of spends time with all the different cliques. He's never really been someone who just has one or two mates and, you know, that's it. He's very popular amongst all the kind of members of the squad. And I think Ange kind of likes that. You know, this, and it's not just because Harry's gone. I think, you know, Son is really stepping up into this kind of role. And, you know, when we talked about players stepping up into the void, you know, it's a kind of cliche thing, isn't it? But you can see how Son has done that in all ways, not just on the pitch, but I think off the pitch as well. You know, he really feels like this is his team now. And yeah, I mean, I just picking up on your point about them being lucky. I mean, I also think that it's not a coincidence you get teams like Postecoglou's teams are lucky. You know, it wasn't a coincidence that Man United under Ferguson were lucky and that City under Guardiola are lucky. It comes from basically having the ball more, having the ball in the final third more, getting more penalty area touches than the opponents. You know, you get more penalties, you get more chances, you get more late goals because the opposition are more tired because they spent way more time without the ball. It is a little bit of luck. It is a little bit of luck, but equally, it's part of the tactics. You know, these are 95, 98, 100-minute games now, and if you spend the whole game without the ball, it's not chance that the opponents die in those last 5 or 10 minutes. They switch off mentally or physically. So, yeah, there is a little bit of luck. I do think Spurs have probably taken a little bit more points than they might have deserved, but it's also down to the way they're playing.
I agree. We talked about this again in the pod. You know, also, their fitness levels are very, very impressive. I just saw some stats the other day, which were quite interesting, about chances created. And Kieran Trippier of Newcastle, obviously ex-Spurs, Spurs fans know him well, is top of the list with 22 chances created. But then it's Maddison on 21 and Kulusevski just behind with 20. So that sort of speaks to your point. They're creating chances all over, in every game. It feels like this is the first game where the narrative has been about Spurs being lucky rather than fully deserving the result, which is, again, speaks to how well Postecoglou is doing. But I just wanted to pose a question about Son. And Tom's talking about his change of when he's played out left, maybe being a bit too isolated. When he's been at his best playing out left, who's been the left back out of interest? Because obviously, in this team, it's Udogi who's playing very much an inverted left back. Does Son thrive when he's playing out there with a more traditional sort of overlapping left back? Has it been Davis in the years gone by, or has it been Danny Rose? I mean, you guys were watching Spurs way more than I was, you know, from a journalistic point of view during those years. Who really sticks out?
I hadn't really thought of that. I mean, there was a whole thing last season about whether the wing-back system and Perisic being in similar areas was kind of crowding him out. But I've not really considered whether it's to do with who's behind him. It would obviously have been Rose under Pochettino most of the time, or Davis. Then, I guess, Davis and Reguilon. Now, Udogi. Son doesn't really... He's not really the kind of winger who has had a sort of telepathic relationship with the left-back. So I've never really considered whether that's contributed significantly to his form, but it's, yeah, definitely something worth thinking about.
I also think we kind of think of Son when he's been at his most dangerous with Kane, and it was probably when Spurs were more of a kind of a counter-attacking team. Isn't that fair to say? I mean, I've always felt that Son has always been at his best when Spurs have been kind of exploding out of the blocks. You know, like that's kind of the Tottenham of the last kind of 4 or 5 years where, you know, they've been hitting teams on the break quick and the space has kind of been there. Kane gets it on the turn and then, you know, flicks that ball around the corner into kind of Son's channel. And it's not that kind of thing of sort of Neville and Bex where, you know, long build up and I get the ball and then play the ball down the line to you running onto it. It's never really been like that, has it? And probably a good thing because Spurs haven't had a good left back for years.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. Yeah, I mean, he was such a threat in counter-punching teams. He was so good in transition under Mourinho and Conte. And I think he really became like a counter-attacking winger for a while. And part of the reason, I think, in the first 3 league games of the season, he didn't quite look up to speed was because he was having to adjust to suddenly being part of a team which didn't have loads of space ahead of them to canter into. You know, they were generally trying to pick their way through a more crowded final third. And that's just not been his game, really, over the last 4 seasons, more or less. He's been used to kind of, as you said, feeding off Kane's service and running into space. Again, I think him at number 9 in this new look team kind of suits him well because he can sort of come alive over short distances. Like his goals against Liverpool and Arsenal, his first goal against Arsenal, was very much a kind of dart ahead of the defender. And he's still got that kind of speed of acceleration and speed of thought and kind of awareness in the box. And he's also a, you know, fantastic finisher. He generally, I think, has outperformed his XG over most of his seasons at Spurs. You know, he generally, you know, sort of scores more than he should, which is testament to kind of how good he is at finishing chances.
Also, seems to me that it has the kind of byproduct of putting Richarlison maybe out on the left, which I actually quite like. I think it kind of has taken the pressure off Richarlison a bit. You know, he's not the kind of one down the middle who needs to score all of Harry Kane's goals. It's just kind of taken a little bit out of the limelight, and maybe Richarlison can kind of just sort of work his way back into form and confidence out there where he kind of is more a provider and presser and you know, helping to provide for Son rather than kind of leading the line.
Yeah. Yes, I think it's, you know, the brilliance of Son, that telepathic relationship with Harry Kane was critical. And of course, last season, he was struggling physically, and I think that more than anything had an effect on both his goal tally and his overall performance. But I'm just loving watching him play. You know, I want him to play down the middle, but if he has to go out wide again at times, if Ange thinks that it could work against certain opponents, I haven't got a problem with that. But I also think that Richarlison is better suited in that position. And just the fact that we've got, you know, Brennan Johnson, hopefully he's not going to be out for too long. Manus Solomon, a really good signing. Let's not forget, I think he provides us and will provide us with options at times. And before we go on to a defender that's caught our eye, I'd like to mention Kulusevski as well, guys, whose fitness levels are obviously fantastic. Burst onto the scene when he first arrived, was disappointing last season. And I know he can be a little bit one-dimensional at times. You kind of know when he picks up that ball out wide that he'll look to cut back inside. But he's becoming a threat. And I feel maybe he hasn't been given the credit that he deserves so far this season. Perhaps that's because the likes of Bissouma and Maddison and Son and everybody else has been so good. But are we all really happy, excited with what Kulusevski's doing and what he might go on to do over the next few years?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's someone who's quietly been impressing without sort of grabbing the headlines. And every time I watch him at the moment, I think he's growing as the front three in particular start to learn a bit more what Postecoglou wants from him. I mean, Kulusevski's told us throughout pre-season and in mixed zones that, you know, specifically Postecoglou wants him to stay out wide and look to fit, you know, get in on the crosses from the other winger, whether that be Son, Richarlison, whoever's playing out there. But there's a lot more to it than that. And I feel like he's being a little less predictable. For a long time, it was cut in, have a shot towards the far post, a little bit like Antony at Man United, just a bit too obvious what he's going to do. And there are moments where he still does that. But with the way Spurs build up from the back on both sides with these sort of triangles as they work up the pitch involving any of the midfielders, but I suppose particularly on that right-hand side, Saar and Porro and Romero, Kulusevski's slowly starting to fit in very well into that. And there's a bit more understanding, I think, with every passing game of how those little intricate movements and passing movements fit in all these players. And as I said earlier, statistically, he's creating only two fewer chances than the most highest creator in the league. His fitness levels, as we said before, are off the charts. And he's scored a couple of goals, but I think there's more to come. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of the season, the more he is in tune with the way Postecoglou wants to play, he ends up with close to 10 goals.
I still think he's a bit predictable.
Yeah, he is, Dan. But I think I still think that maybe, as Tom says, he's playing to order to a degree, and he will develop more variety, given a bit of extra belief. And then maybe Ange will say, all right, mate, I didn't realise you could do that. All right, carry on, son. There we are. Got to get that in once every few weeks.
Yes, I can't disagree with that, Marcus. Yeah, no, I think he's so good at finding space and creating space and using his body to hit the ball. He's got so much going for him. I just like to see him be a bit more varied when he gets in dangerous positions. A few people raise the idea of playing on the left, which I think could be quite interesting. So I think at the moment, his default is kind of always going to be out inside on his left foot and kind of whip that cross to the back post. And obviously, in his first half season in England, that was kind of so effective because I think people weren't really sure what he was going to do, you know, opponents. They know now, so it's kind of on him to mix it up a little bit. He did that, you know, well against United when he got the assist for Sarr's goal, for example. So he has been doing it more, but, you know, I'd like to see that increase. And I think, as Tom says, as everyone adjusts to Postecoglou's way of playing, they'll get better.
Just on that, I feel like that there was a movement against Arsenal, which does show a little bit how he's adapting and not being as predictable. It was the Brennan Johnson chance, which, you know, David Raya made a good save, but he was coming in and pretty much every time I've watched him, I would have expected him to have a shot towards the far post, but he slipped in Son, who then laid it back for Johnson. And I just feel like there's been a bit more of that recently. It's a little less, as you say, predictable, and being a bit more in tune with where his teammates are going to be. So I would, as I said, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw him, you know, getting more assists or more assists of the assists and becoming more of an integral part of this team.
Yeah. I would like to present Marcus's Australian accent to a native Australian and actually find out where in Australia that might belong. Because it doesn't seem to me it's sort of a Melbourne accent. I think it's more of a kind of like, it's quite wild, isn't it? It's quite unhinged. I sort of wonder if it's a bit sort of like more like the outback somewhere, you know, like the deep middle of Ayers Rock or something.
Fair dinkum. I've travelled across Australia's wonderful lands with a bit of Greek background, and that's why.
I think it's quite crocodile.
I didn't say we wanted more.
No, sorry. Okay, no. Just one. Whenever I think of Kulusevski, by the way, I also think of Bentancur because they arrived at the same time. And how exciting is it to think that within a month or so, he should be back in the frame? And I just think he's going to fit in superbly. So further reason, I said at the start of the show, why we've got this feel-good factor, and the January transfer window is not that far away if we think we need a few more additions. So things are looking good. And one player who came in during the summer and has, I think, caught everybody's eye, he's quick, he's determined, he's formed this incredibly effective partnership with Romero just about from the word go. I'm talking about Mickey van der Ven, of course. And Tom B has been having a chat with Wim Jonk. Now, what a player he was for the likes of Ajax and Inter, PSV, and of course Sheffield Wednesday in England. And Jonk, who is currently the technical manager at FC Volendam, is largely responsible, I think it's fair to say, for the development of van der Ven and where he is today, because he spotted him in an under-19s match when he was at Volendam. And Tom had a chat and started by just asking him if he's been really pleasantly surprised by the impact the young Dutchman has already made.
Yeah, it's a great impact because and I'm very proud because first he went to Germany and he took some time to get into the rhythm of games, and also he's physically made big steps forward because it's a different league as well, and also a different approach for him. And then he went to Tottenham, and yeah, that's a league day where every young player wants to play, but it's very physically, it's very, you have to be mentally very strong, especially when you come from a club from Wolfsburg, from Germany, into the big league like Tottenham, and you play against the best strikers in the world. Yeah, he impressed me a lot, and yeah.
Tell us about what you know of him and his development, and when you first started working with him.
Yeah, the first time I saw him playing, he was a young lad, and he was playing in the under-19s. But I saw a player who was physically very strong, a tall player, and he made some his explosiveness was so impressed for me. But I saw also there was a lot of work to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he could easily outnumber the players, and he could run with the ball, and he was so impressed for me to and he made his mistakes as well, because sometimes his positioning was not the best, but I was so keen on his performance that day, and so I was impressed what I saw the first couple of times. And that's the reason I have a chat with the technical director to get him a positioning higher to the second team.
When he signed for Tottenham, he did an interview with the club, and he was talking about his journey. And he actually said at Volendam, if I pronounced that right, there was a moment it sounds like a bit before you spotted him, where there might have been a youth coach who didn't actually think he was going to make it, but then he obviously turned it around, and now he's playing in the Premier League. Do you remember that? Why would someone think that at that stage? You mentioned he needed a lot to work on. Was he quite raw at that point?
It's a very strange story. If you look back on that story, then you think, how is that possible? Because to recognize the individual talents is from the scouting inside Volendam, but also from outside. Yeah, if I watched him, I was so impressed. And also, okay, every young player makes mistakes, but you have to look forwards and think about where could he be in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's. Everybody can see with different eyes, and it was for him so stressful at that time, because there were a lot of doubts about him, and they say and I couldn't understand it.
Mm.
And then that's the reason. He was not a finished product. So. And there was a lot of things to do with positioning, the passing, the heading. Everything could be better, for example. But those were things we could work on. And he was a player who would take the initiative, and he was not too afraid to make mistakes.
Mm.
That's what I like in him as well. Sometimes he was a bit lazy as well, but. That come out of his because he had such a talent. So you have to give him a goal every day, and then you get the best out of him. And that's what the team we are now, the coaching team at Volendam.
Mm.
We work especially on the weapons of a player, and he had a lot of weapons. He's physically and. We build on the physically side as well. They put him 8 to 10 kilos extra on. Yeah, and all those small parts of the puzzle came along, and we built him from there. He did a great job, and because the player has to do it by himself, but we could help him, and we worked hard with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the reason he he made the big steps forward.
You mentioned you helped him put 8 to 10 kilos on. So how did you go about putting that weight on? Was he eating a particular diet? Can you give me any sort of details over how you managed to achieve that?
We changed that as well, because when we started here at Volendam to 2019, there was not the way. We made some big steps forward on every particular side. It's about the nutrition side, but also the vitamins, all those things, but also the intensity of the physically training sessions, not just on the pitch, but also off the pitch. And also the mental strength of a player we worked on. Yeah, he was already very mentally strong because he worked with his father as well. Mm-hmm. And he helped him a lot as well. But yeah, we worked with him because of his... you saw a raw diamond. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of things to help him with, especially the heading, the positioning in the game. 5 meters up front, 5 meters backwards. Press forward, defending forward. Yeah, and now he's more relaxed on the ball. And that's what you see now. And that's a big step forward.
How do you work on his what do you call it, mental strength? What do you do to make someone mentally stronger?
Yeah, but sometimes you put him in another position. Also in midfield sometimes, but also in position games, we put him in different places and to work on his technical side as well, and on the mental side, yeah, you have to work with him, making captain, for example. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, we made him captain because if you play from the back, you have to coach more. You have to help the midfield players and take responsibility. And I was thinking, okay, if we put him the band home, that give him a big responsibility for the team. Especially, I know he was a young player, but for me, it was very important for him to develop those points. And but also that means something for a player because you have to step out your comfort zone and to help him with all those small things to create a player who takes an initiative and help other players, be an example for young players, but also step up to the older ones. Yeah, those sort of things you have to think about.
Well, Tom, high praise indeed from Wim Jonk, who knows what he's talking about. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to see that. Sorry, I'll say that again. Well, really interesting to hear what Wim Jonk had to say there. And Tom, it's no exaggeration, is it, to say that Van de Ven has settled in so well. We knew he had pace. We're starting to see that. Okay, maybe he didn't get quite as tight to Gakpo as he should have done for the Liverpool goal the other day. But marks out of 10 for him and the relationship he's formed with Romero?
Very high. I mean, the guy signed, 5 days, if that, before the start of the season. He's played every minute bar one. I think he came off, forget which game it was, in the 89th minute, but he also played the full League Cup game. I know we don't mention that on this podcast anymore, but he's been an ever-present. We saw, particularly against Liverpool, that the feigned pace he had when he came in, which I don't think we've actually seen too much of throughout his time at Spurs so far, which speaks to how much they've been dominating games and not needed it so far. But yeah, he seems to have it all. Which makes it all the more surprising, even with all the players we've all interviewed over the years, where their story often starts from being written off at an early age and almost released. The fact that he was sort of 18 and almost released by Volendam because they didn't think he was good enough, and the fact that he's only 22 now and starring in the Premier League, that one does seem very striking and huge credits to Wim Jonk for spotting his potential, because he wouldn't be doing what he is now. He might not even be playing football if the other coaches had their way. But yeah, back to your original question. I mean, I can't really give him lower than a 9, to be honest, for an impact.
I found it interesting, Jonk, kind of talking about the mental toughness side. I think, so often when clubs sign these young players. They look at their ability and their kind of talents, and obviously Van de Ven has a lot of that, not just physically, but, you know, technically as well. But I think they always, you know, really put a big emphasis on kind of adversity that's been overcome and obstacles that have been sort of jumped, you know. And I like that kind of thing about Jonk sort of giving him the captaincy early on, and also allowing him that kind of freedom to make mistakes, which I think we heard from Postecoglou in his press conference last week. Dan asked a question about kind of youngsters and getting the best out of them, and was he surprised how quickly they kind of hit the ground running. And I thought his answer was really interesting, Postecoglou. He was kind of talking about how essentially you have to almost make the players feel like it doesn't matter too much, you know, and that might sound a bit kind of strange for a football manager kind of saying that to his players, but that actually it's, the stakes aren't so high. You know, your career is not going to be ended if you make a mistake. The world's not going to end if you do something wrong. And I think that kind of thing with Van de Ven here is the same. You know, it's this idea of allowing kind of young players to go out and not feel under pressure. And I think if we kind of look at the compare and contrast with Conte, for example, I can imagine that was just really not the atmosphere that was there in the dressing room. You know, I think Postecoglou, people talk about freedom and the ability to kind of attack and enjoy and create and things. And that is all there. But I think really underneath all of that is the kind of the confidence of the manager. And it'll be interesting to see, because that hasn't really been tested yet, I guess, the theory. You know, we haven't seen that many mistakes, but it'll be interesting to see if Van de Ven does make a howler, or if Vicario kind of, you know, passes the ball to someone in his 6-yard box. Then I imagine Postecoglou will demonstrate this by kind of, you know, keeping the faith and sticking him in the team the next week. But we haven't seen that yet, because Van de Ven has been superb.
Well, he has. And I think back to the start of the season, and I think I understand why we were all a little bit concerned that although Spurs might score some goals, they were going to be on the receiving end, and they still might. But what a start, what a combination from those two. And what an opportunity, guys, over the next three games. Now, the word I hate more than anything else when discussing Tottenham is Spursy. Everybody else likes to bang on about that. My only fear now, if we're going to use that ridiculous word, is, okay, we've got Luton coming up. We've got Crystal Palace, who've got all sorts of injury problems. We've got Fulham. And we owe them one after the game to which we shall never make reference once more. And Chelsea in the distance as well. But the next three games, you think, okay, 9 points is a very real possibility. Starting at Luton, Rob Edwards speaks very eloquently. He's become very frustrated by the fact that just about all the pundits have written Luton off quite disparagingly, including Garth Crooks, actually. But the fact that they lost at home to Burnley last night, Dan, suggests to me that the critics know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched a huge amount of them, I have to say. But, I mean, obviously Spurs have got to be looking at this game as one they should be winning, and winning pretty comfortably, I think. You couldn't really ask for a better fixture at the moment. As you said, they've just lost to Burnley at home. They would have been coming into the Premier League probably thinking, OK, we're short of a bit of quality here, but we've got a really unique kind of home ground that's going to be a really difficult place to come, you know, particularly sort of under the light, and, you know, particularly against a side like Burnley, who are, you know, kind of trying to play a certain way, and then perhaps, you know, won't like being roughed up, as it were. But, you know, clearly that hasn't been the case, or that wasn't the case last night. So, yeah, I think Spurs, you know, should be looking to come there and kind of dominate the ball and, you know, get themselves in a position of strength kind of as quickly as possible. And Pleaty will be there and be excited. Obviously, it's the David Pleat derby, isn't it? You know, that's a reason to enjoy this fixture. But yeah, I think Spurs should be going there with eyes on a kind of commanding win to continue their unbeaten run into the international break.
Actually, talking of Pleaty, guys, I mean, could you grab him after the game, and let's find out how he's doing with pronunciations for some of the new Spurs players. I'd love to know if he can get Udogie right for a start. I mean, I think even Pleaty could manage Madison. Van de Ven might cause him a few problems.
To be fair, Dan is still struggling with Udogie. Dan hasn't got it right, I don't think, yet. So.
Guglielmo Vicario, that could be a...
Oh, no, he's had it with that. He's had it. He's totally gone with that one. But, yeah, this is, I mean, obviously, though,
he's going to start with those guys, isn't he? We're not going to start. And this is where I trust Postecoglou after what happened at Fulham. You go there, as Dan said, you make sure you're two or three up, hopefully, after the hour, and then take him off. Tom, Steve?
I think this is going to be a little bit harder than that, and I really hope they don't go and be complacent by resting their best players. Because when you look at Luton so far this season, they haven't really been battered by anyone. I know I think they lost 4-1 on the opening day at Brighton, but there were some late goals there, or maybe Chelsea as well. But generally, they've been quite close games. They obviously shocked Everton with that victory, kind of completely dispelling some of the criticism they've had. I mean, Garth Crooks did go very strong by saying they thought they would be relegated by Christmas, which is just, I don't think is actually mathematically possible. And watching a little bit of them, you know, particularly in that Everton game, obviously their goals came from set pieces. They look very strong from that side of the game. I don't know if Spurs have really struggled from that this season so far. So I'm sure they'll be able to match that. But you know, Carlton Morris up front has looked pretty handy. He's got quite a few goals already, albeit quite a few from the penalty spot. But he's someone they're going to have to watch out for. And Alfie Doherty as well, in this sort of wing back system, out wide, seems to be their most creative threat. So I you know, Rob Edwards is someone that has worked his way up the game. There's actually a bit of a parallel between him and Postecoglou in terms of they both ended their career pretty young, I think, through injury. And it's not like they're someone who's been dropped straight into it at a high level because of their name. Obviously, we know all about Postecoglou's nomadic route to the top, but Rob Edwards is someone who has gone through the FA, working, I think, with the under-19s or under-20s, went to Forest Green, went to Watford, who obviously Luton's big rivals. It didn't work out there, and then got picked up by Luton and has done a very, very good job. So I think if Spurs take any game, obviously, in the Premier League lightly, but particularly this one, just because it's Luton, they could be in for a bit of a shock. But having said that, the way they handled Burnley away from home and the way Postecoglou's got them playing, I feel like compared to a lot of teams, I don't worry as much about Spurs for a sort of potential banana skin like this one.
Yeah, well, hopefully we won't be smearing egg off our faces come Saturday afternoon. Of course, it's the early kickoff, the 12:30 kickoff. One other subject before we go: some crypto controversy. Tom A, you know a bit about this. Just paint the picture for us, could you?
Yeah, I mean, I know a bit about it. I don't know loads about crypto, but I know the risks that have come, you know, with football, kind of dipping their toes into this. And it's, I think most people you talk to are kind of very surprised that Tottenham are linking up with Sotheby's at this point. It feels like 3 or 4 years ago, football was getting really excited about this, and you know, loads of clubs, even UEFA, kind of partnered with Sotheby's. In this idea, there was, you know, lots of money to be made, but most clubs and players as well have been left with kind of eggs on their faces, because, you know, the value of these fan tokens, you know, plummet. And actually, I mean, just to very briefly explain what it is, I guess, is that, you know, it's essentially a way for a company to kind of offer fans tokens, which they then use to kind of enter competitions and win prizes and to kind of have a vote in club polls that are basically kind of just invented and, you know, don't really give people a say on anything in particular. It's a way of charging fans for supposed engagement, in inverted commas, you know. And I guess, you know, the basic principle here is that fans are already very much charged for their engagement by having to pay very high prices for their tickets. And the idea that clubs are now going to be not only kind of encouraging fans to pay more money, but also to kind of invest their money in a scheme which, I guess we have to be a little bit careful what we say here legally, but, you know, in scheme that has historically been proven to be fairly kind of up and down, fragile. So, it surprises me that Spurs are kind of going in for this. Maybe the timing isn't that surprising because, you know, they're doing so well. Possibly the club kind of thought this is a good moment to kind of just, you know, drip this out there. But hopefully supporters will be very wary, I think, hopefully, of what's happened before. I mean, West Ham, for example, linked up with Sotheby's in 2019 And within a year, they'd cancelled the partnership. And I believe not even one fan had invested any money in a token. So let's see. But hopefully Spurs fans are aware of the history and how these things can go.
Yes, a little word of warning there. I liked Postecoglou. In fact, Dan, you were telling us that, and this is where he's clever as well, Postecoglou. Of course, as the manager, he's going to get asked about everything. But he batted away that question quite skillfully, didn't he, in terms of knowing what he is an expert on and what he'll leave to other people.
Yeah, it was our colleague Charlie Eccleshare from The Athletic asked him about the Socios partnership, and he said effectively that he wouldn't want someone from the marketing team commenting on football, so he wasn't going to comment on marketing decisions, which, yeah, was a very eloquent way of straight batting it and not answering, but I think totally fair enough. And yeah, I would just echo what Tom Warnock says. I think the timing of this is really surprising. It feels like this form of fan token and engagement and sort of crypto has long been discredited. That bubble has effectively burst now, and Spurs are seemingly kind of jumping on the bandwagon because it'll make them some money. So I think, yeah, I encourage fans to be really wary of it and probably not invest in the fan tokens, and certainly not in the Chilis, which is the Socios cryptocurrency that you can kind of, I think, buy more tokens with and sort of trade with. I think in the case of pretty much every club who has done this, the fan tokens have lost value. So it's probably not a particularly sound investment.
Sounds like madness. I don't know why we're getting involved. Anyway, I know that, like Big Ange, I know nothing about the commercial side of things, so I shall not make any further comment. Boys, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard with a token comment there about the tokens and the Chilis. Tom Barkley, who's, I'm sure his token would be worth a lot more than the rest of ours put together. And Tom Allnut, who was in good feisty fashion, none of the pessimism that we've had from Tom over the past. his young son must be sleeping better and he's getting a bit more sleep. So we're all up for it. We're all hoping that by early afternoon on Saturday, Spurs will be top of the Premier League. Who knows? Thank you so much for listening. I'm Marcus Buckland. Do keep your comments coming, your reviews, your suggestions. We'd love to hear if there's anything in particular that you'd like us to focus on a bit more. It's an interactive process, so do continue to get in touch with us here at the Tottenham Way. Thanks so much for listening, and of course, come on, you super Spurs.